Bat Segundo here, and I'm pleased to announce that our young roving correspondent has finally met his match. For Robert Birnbaum, a man far better with the rolling questions than our titmouse of an interviewer, has finally set our young pipsqueak in his place. Or has he? You make the call, you be the judge, and listen.
I am here with the one, the only, the ultimate literary interviewer here in Boston at Mount Auburn Cemetery with Robert Birnbaum, the man who is behind Identity Theory, The Morning News, and many other sort of operations. His elaborate, and Rosie is actually in the car, I understand, too. She's pissed off because she can't wander the cemetery. Well, first off, the obvious question here is why meet in a cemetery? What is it about cemeteries? And you had mentioned to me before we started this that you conducted several literary interviews here at the cemetery.
I don't know that they're literary interviews, but I just think it's a nice venue. And if you look over there, You see a nice view of Boston and parts of Cambridge. So it's just a congenial place. And this cemetery, I've always enjoyed coming through here any number of times because every time I come through here, I get lost and then I see new parts of it. I mean, there's some incredible headstones and it's just an amazing place. So,
and this is like one of the oldest cemeteries.
Yeah, and I think that the estate taxes paid out of here probably could support Central America for about two centuries.
Likely.
So it's the Cabots and the Lodges and the Saltonstalls and everybody else who meant anything in the New England royalty probably are buried here. So that's one reason for being here.
Oh, it's all odd because we
don't just... I get to introduce you? This is Robert Birnbaum. I'm talking to Ed Champion.
Oh, well.
At least once arrested this year. has your case come to trial yet?
You know, actually I did, and I had to end up paying this $350.
Justice did not prevail?
Yeah, justice did not prevail. I'm sorry.
And you didn't start a campaign?
No.
Oh my God! No. What happened?
I was humiliated enough by the fact that. It's at least over and done with, and now there's a complaint out against the police officers. So we shall see what happens. I suspect.
But
nothing
now you're
much.
A once convicted felon.
No, no,
of sorts.
No, no. Infraction.
Oh, it's an infraction.
It's an infraction. It's not even a misdemeanor, thankfully.
But it doesn't even rise to being a misdemeanor.
Yes, I am a convicted litter bug. So.
But, all right.
Okay, well, should we refer to you as Robert or Bob? Or
Robert. Robert's good.
Okay, Robert's good?
Robert's
okay,
good. Yeah.
Okay, good.
Or Red.
Or Red, okay.
Or El Rojo.
El Rojo. Well, okay, I'll call you El Rojo then, since this is Bat Segundo. Well, what is the current state of the literary? This is an obvious sort of question, but I have no questions prepared in advance. This is an impromptu kind of thing. So what is the current state of the literary climate?
That kind of question just begs me to say that I'm just one of the blind men feeling around the elephant. Mm-hmm. I mean, I whatever piece of the literary world that I'm familiar with is probably not large enough. Although the literary world itself is not so large, I would beg off and say either I only see a small piece of it, or it isn't that large, and I don't really care to make grandiose statements about the state of things. I don't know. I would say, like the rest of the world, it's in flux. Mm-hmm. You know. Although, if you want to ask me what the state of Sam Tenenhouse's bowels are, I might be more.
Well, what is the current state of Mr. Tenenhouse?
Well, I suspect since he's rejected all your overtures about his brownies, he probably has a digestive problem, and that's the real reason he's not eating your treats.
And he's just too embarrassed
to talk about his fundamental
problem.
Yeah,
you know.
I think that there's backwardly answer your question. I think there's probably too much sort of meta conversation about the state of the world. So I don't know who's really fit to talk about it, even self-appointed, experts.
Well, what specific meta conversation are you referring to here?
The one about the literary world, the state of the literary world.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that would mean I'd have to step out of it, which is kind of not what I want to do. I actually enjoy stepping into it. I suppose, because it's a part of the world that I'm very comfortable with. Mm-hmm. You know, even when there are suggestions that it's small and marginal, you know, it's small and marginal and perhaps disconnected from reality, that's all fine with me.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, I don't know. I'm trying to think of what purpose it would serve me personally to assess its state, other than maybe become like Chicken Little or something like that, which is already too much of, oh, it's falling, it's you know.
Well, I mean, not necessarily sort of like some sort of like alarmist question here, just more of a kind of like, you know, a barometer more than anything
else. No, I
know,
but, well, I think it's probably, I would say that it appears to me that there's lots of public conversation,
yeah.
Lots of wonderful literary work being done, and people are embarking on new literary projects, meaning magazines and you know, new formats of presenting the information, and that all looks hopeful to me, mm-hmm. You know. And there's even the silly comedy, comedic moments, like these big, you know, trade shows,
yeah.
Where people get to be, you know, pompous and whatever they are.
It's utter such silly statements as we are under no obligation to acknowledge the Brownies, which
or to say that something they do is the best,
or to reject you know, any kind of online conduit as prattle, essentially.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. And there's I think you know, it reminds me that I forget who gets the credit for this quote, but somebody said something about the fact that that literary squabbles are so bitter because they're about such small stakes.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Are there too many literary feuds going on, or not enough? There hasn't been I was discussing this actually with Sarah, oddly enough. Yes. Yeah.
Am I a third party in this interview?
You're a third party in this.
I see, okay.
Okay. We were discussing that there hasn't been some really sort of major violent feud in some time. I mean, you know, there's the, you know, the Richard Ford Colson Whitehead, you know, spitting. There's the Dale Peck bitch slap. But this is really, you know, small potatoes. I mean, if we're dwelling so much on this, it's like...
I don't can never consider those literary.
Yeah.
At all. I mean, they just happen to be moments that included, you know, literary people, but they weren't literary. I mean, you know, Richard Ford's really prickly and touchy about his work, and you know, if you knew his history, you'd know that if you trashed him in print, he'd do something really pissy about it.
Yeah.
You know, despite the fact that he's actually a pretty decent guy. But I mean, I don't know. He's not abashed about saying that when Alice Hoffman badly reviewed one of his books in the Times, that he took one of her books out into his backyard and shot it.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think he shot two copies. I think his wife, Christina,
right,
gave him another. So, you know, and he enjoys that. But, you know, and then, you know, I mean, I'm not going to justify the rudeness of spitting at someone, but, you know, what do you expect someone to do? What polite thing are you supposed to do when somebody trashes something near and dear to you?
Well, you know, you go ahead and listen instead of spit.
Maybe.
I mean, in this...
Yeah, if you're a rational... Maybe.
But
I mean,
then again, we're talking Richard Ford here.
No,
yeah.
No, but, you know, I mean, there's supposed to be a right thing to do. And,
yeah.
And I think, you know, I think that if you're really honest, if somebody trashes your work,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people rise to the, you know, to the dignity of being open and accepting it, but it's still painful.
Yeah.
You know, and I think people are too quick to dismiss the pain of that. I mean... I sort of, again, I don't, the response isn't my kind of response, but...
it's the quiet response for Richard Ford.
I get the emotion of it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and Stanley Crouch, I think, is just a creep, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, So, are there not enough of those? Well, you know, those are sideshows, and... You know, they're good stories. I mean, they really are good stories, you know. I mean, despite the fact that I hated what he did, one of my favorite things to get pissed off about is Leon Wiseau-Thier's trashing of Nick Baker,
yeah.
You know, in a review.
I was upset by that, too, because,
you know?
Nicholson Baker, here he's been, you know, this innovator all along, and he goes ahead and does this one political book, and now, you know, what's happened to Nick Baker, you know? What's he doing now? He's just, like, putting out collections of, like, the Times World.
I don't worry about Nick. I think he's a clever guy. He's a good writer.
Yeah.
He's a good guy. I think his the book, the newspaper repository he founded was just such a honorable, decent thing to do. Putting, you know, he cashed in his IRA to rescue a bunch of old newspaper bound newspapers from the British Library. You know, he believed in it, so I think that was. He's a good guy, and so you know, for someone to like, I think I think that the Leon Wieseltier thing was worse than, in my mind, worse than Richard Ford spitting.
Possibly, you know? So because, well, it's just it defames criticism and it defaces, you know, the notion of like, well, you know, I mean, for all my quibbles with the New York Times Book Review, I mean, I certainly hope that it can actually find a kind of, you know, way to restore its previous glory, whatever that might have been, you know.
Well,
but it's just like,
I thought that I think I wrote about this. I actually was able cogent enough for about an hour to put this stuff together. But I think that I read somewhere that Jennifer Howard had some smart comments about whether the Times actually ever was the gold standard.
Yeah.
And more to the point is I don't you know, a lot of people who will not go public on this because they get work from the Times don't like the Times Book Review, don't like, you know. So there's a very interesting sub-tone going on that you're never going to hear about because it doesn't make any political sense for writers to trash the Times, but it's far less
except for me
highly regarded and me, because, you know, I'm with you.
I mean, it's the thing is okay, after I did my little sort of, you know, confrontation.
Are we talking about you?
Well, no,
we're supposed to be talking about me.
We'll get back to you. Don't worry. No. It relates to what we're talking about. But anyway, I had people come up to me at Book Expo and say, "Oh, what a courageous thing you did." I'm like, what?
Yeah, really.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, I it wasn't all that courageous. It was just like, you know, a bit. But
well,
apparently,
no
one.
You don't know any better.
Yeah.
You weren't raised with that kind of like. You know, I must say I'm like that too. I never have any consciousness of how you burn a bridge.
Yeah.
You know, I apparently burned a bunch of them, but I didn't know it when I was doing it. So.
Yeah.
You know, I guess we're both better off in that way.
Well, at the same time, like, you know, you always. Maybe some things aren't meant to happen, and why sort of compromise who you are by, you know, sort of playing
so you can
this
eat.
Kind of, yeah, well, there's the eating thing, but
so
you know.
So you can pay for your kids' dental bills and stuff?
Look, I mean, yeah, there's that too, but you know, I mean, look at someone like Anthony Burgess, who pretty much pissed off almost everyone, and yet he was able to still make a living writing newspaper articles.
Yeah,
it's like...
Well, England is a,
but that's,
a different scene for writers.
Yeah.
You know, here it's just, it's very, it's, I'm fascinated by the big divide between fiction and nonfiction and journalism. You know, we don't have a Grub Street tradition here, which is really weird to me. I guess it's because there's more writing programs here that establish these fenced off areas.
Sure.
You know.
Sure.
So.
Well, since we're on the subject of journalism, I should bring up like one thing that you had mentioned to me, and you had mentioned, I think, publicly in a couple of like your blog comments, is like you were sort of troubled by either being identified as literary journalist or even the Ozick bookish journalist didn't even name you. but not that, but it was more of like... What...
Cynthia can say anything she wants about me. I adore her. Even a passing reference, you know, was fine with me. I, you know, she's a total gem.
We got to set you guys up then.
she's happily married.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Plus, she never leaves her house. I'm not as agoraphobic as...
But, just to get off on what I was sort of suggesting here, and that was, you were saying you weren't sure what the role of the literary journalist was today, and that you may not actually have felt comfortable about being identified that way. Maybe you can kind of elaborate upon this.
Can I say that I'm quite willing to revise or repudiate anything I've said in the past?
That's fine.
In the spirit of...
That's fine. People change. Opinions change.
Yeah, and people don't remember what they say. And,
oh, yeah.
So, I don't know. I guess I sometimes find, you know, sort of talking about using the hammers, you know, a bit too, when you're doing carpentry, you don't really shouldn't be spending that much time talking about using the hammers and being a carpenter. You should kind of do the stuff. And you know, this sort of seems to be part of the, it's like, I guess your computer, not only does it create things, but it also, when it creates them, also it needs to label them. And identify them. So I think that's a contemporary ill. While you're doing something, you also are obliged to, you know, identify what it is that you're doing. Which, and I go like, well, why? You know, I sort of like the protean approach, which is, you know, you sort of do the stuff, and then I guess my view of the world and life is that you sort of, the fun of it is you just sort of toss that, put things in play, mm-hmm. you know, in any number of areas, and personally and, you know, whatever professionally means, you just sort of, you know, it's all play, you know, and you see how it plays out, you know, you play baseball, you want to put the ball in play, and, you know, most of the time the fielders field it, and sometimes they don't, and sometimes you put it in a place where they can't get it, and that's even better, but, so, I think that there's a lot of time, to me, it's a lot of time wasted in sort of self-evaluation, categorization, you know, that I think is better served sort of focusing. It seems to me it's more internal and more mirrored than it is sort of paying attention to what's more interesting, which is out there.
But I guess, though, some people, though, need a reference point, or they need some sort of taxonomy to latch onto, so that therefore they can actually go ahead and understand that what you do or what anyone else does. I mean, you know, is it wrong to label, like, Birnbaum literary journalists? I mean, that at least provides a...
I'm surprised. If I said that, I must have been having a bad day or something. Or just been cranky or contrary.
No, I'm just trying to feel you out on the issue. We could get everything on record right now. So.
Well, I do think I'm a journalist because, like, I'm curious and I want to know about a bunch of different things. So I'm always sort of sticking my nose into stuff. And most of the time that has to do with things that have to do with literature and storytelling. And so I guess that would make me... I know what I am not is a blogger for a number of reasons. I am not a blogger because that word sucks, and I can't believe that people still use that word. It's a terrible.
But you did Oscar blog. I'll have you know.
I know.
Yeah, and you actually adjusted. To
that
the
was
form.
For you.
Yeah, but you adjusted to the form really, really very good. Very
I did?
Well. Yeah, yeah, you did a very good job, I thought.
See, guys, goes to show you, I think that was my monkey that did that. Goes to show you any, no, I'm just
that,
kidding.
Yeah, now you know the secret behind all bloggers. It's our, like, you know, our, like, just...
Just get 40,000 monkeys at keyboard, and your Das Kapital will be pumped out shortly. No, it's just that I don't like the word, number one. And number two, I think it just, I do think that some mediation is necessary. I mean, I think I'm a fairly expressive, competent and expressive person, and I still enjoy the editing process, self-editing and others editing me. I think pouring stuff out, you know, like in some kind of mind dump is just what it is. It's a mind dump,
yeah.
You know, so that it gets elevated, that it's elevated to something more substantial. Well, you know, I leave it to other people to judge, but somehow it seemed to be more like a frenzied movement than a category of activity. Isn't this wonderful?
This is actually...
It's like sunny and sprinkling.
Well, you have this in New York, but I don't have this in California, this whole hot,
you don't have
muggy...
Rain?
Well, we have rain, but we don't have, like, hot, muggy, plus cold rain, at least in San Francisco.
That's true.
This is really nice, actually. Yeah, I know. Well, okay.
Did I answer your question? I don't think
No, you
I
did, you
question.
Did, but I mean, you know, one might also argue that, you know, well, what you... Your, all of your literary interviews are very prolific. I mean, you know, it's... You also, you know, I don't know how much you read every year. How many books do you read a year?
I think these days I'm finishing somewhere between 60 and 90. And actually starting... You know, what's interesting to me, I just actually noticed, is that I'm finishing less books than ever. Mm-hmm. I'm starting more and I'm finishing less. And, you know, I don't know if it's because I've relaxed my commitment to giving a book a chance. You know, there's a paradox here. You know, like, I know that some books, and I've experienced this, that there are some books you just don't get them until deep into them.
Yeah.
You know, they don't give you a payoff. They don't give you, that you don't crack the code until deep into them. So for some books, it would have been a terrible mistake to give up on them, and whatever your test is, 50 pages, 100 pages,
yeah.
It wouldn't have been fair. On the other hand, you know, why go through the pain of reading X number of pages in a book that just, it's not a statement about the quality of the book. You know, some great books you don't resonate with, you know.
Yeah.
So what? You're not obliged to like every great book, you know, and You're not obliged to disdain every crummy book, you know. So I don't know, you know. So, I read a lot, but I've been reading a lot all my life. But I'm happy to say I'm not as compulsive about finishing everything I start. Huh. But I wanted to say something about the literary blogosphere, which is that the other thing that I think is really, and I guess it's a defensive position, because as much as so-called traditional mainstream journalists and media want to discredit whatever it is that people do in their blogs, there's been this sort of reaction to defend continually defend, you know, the activity and pump it up, and you know, and I think that's so unnecessary. Forget it. Those people are going to say what they say. Just do what, you know, do what you do. Instead of this, like, oh, there's a New York Times attacking, you know, weblogs again. You know, so what?
I mean, okay, I plead guilty to this.
No, what? Everybody who has a weblog does it more or less, you know?
But at the same time, New York Times book review bashing is so in fashion right now. It's so cathartic.
But I agree with you. I think, in fact, it just occurred to me, nothing really untoward happened last week. And I was doing my book notices, and I said, you know, as a private citizen, I'm kind of happy that nothing happened. But as a journalist, where can I complain about? This is terrible. You know?
Yeah.
No one has done anything that I... You know, Sam Tannenhaus hasn't done anything particularly egregious.
Yeah.
You know, any number... You know, Garrison Keillor hasn't come out with something I hate. You know, what am I going to do? How am I going to feel... You know? So
is it the instantaneous kind of idea of the lit blog that you object to?
No, not at all. No, it's not. There's not. No, I think it's all instantaneous when you write it. No, I don't. I think it's the self consciousness of it, and sort of the maybe imbalanced self regard. You know, I mean, why spend so much time defending yourself against people who more or less don't get it? You know, I mean, it's all going to kind of meld in at some point. I mean, you know, there are smart people who are figuring out hybrids of all this. I mean, you know, I think what Chris Lydon is doing at open source is a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. He's got a, you know, 4 hours a week on the radio, and he's got, as far as I can tell, got a very active weblog tied into the radio program. So, you know, that's the kind of stuff, you know, and that's different than the cable TV people who have web iterations that don't strike me as interacting with the content. What I think Christopher and Mary McGrath and those people are doing is trying to create something that actually
weaves together and all
makes sense, you know. So,
well, that's the other thing too, is that, you know, every effort on the part of, like, even Tannenhaus or, you know, any of these book sections to, like, you know, they don't have the community, they don't have the built-in sort of, you know, commentary. It's like, it's, if it is, it's sort of what they choose, and really it's, I think it's more of a, you know, battle between the sort of cultural gatekeeper or the cultural arbiter versus the sort of, like, conversationalist who isn't so fussy about you know, about being the ultimate sort of, you know, having the monopoly on determining taste.
I don't know, you know, I'm confused by everybody's motives or interests in where they stand in relationship to the New York Times. And I really think that Hendrik Hertzberg said it right. I think the New York Times Book Review should be boring. It's a public utility. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be exciting. It doesn't need to do things to call attention to itself. It just needs to pump out on a weekly basis responsible, reasonable coverage of the book world, okay? Which is not what they're doing. This clearly, there's a numbers game going on, and there's, you know, publicity stunting and stuff like that. But here's the other thing. Why do people like you and me and Sarah care what the New York Times... Do you depend on the New York Times?
Not
for
really.
For any information? Are there any books that they write about that you didn't know about before they wrote about them?
Nope. Nope.
Is there any information that you glean from the New York Times book coverage that you didn't know about or didn't have access to before it made the pages?
Generally, no, because... But then again, I'm in a...
So what do you care what they do?
Because other people do care about what they do.
The other people who also don't know about what the Times
is? Yeah, well, there are... I mean, the thing is like, you know, I think literary blogs and a lot of the online conduits are probably doing a much better job at, like, pointing the finger in the direction of, like, you know, really sort of, you know, odd or avant-garde or experimental stuff. I mean, you know, I didn't see Gilbert Sorrentino's obit in the New York Times Book Review, but I did see it in droves online. I mean, you know.
I think it's quite possible that the mentions, Dan Green, among others, the mentions might have driven the Times to sort of up the coverage a week later, right? I think there were two. There might have been two mentions in the time. I don't know about in the book review, but
yeah,
there might have
yeah.
been two mentions in the book pages.
There was a paragraph in the Times for Gilbert Sorrentino. That's troubling.
But you know, it's like, but so what? Why does the New York Times, why do we care if the New York Times recognized, why invest the New York Times with such power? You know, the people who could appreciate, who should appreciate Gilbert Sorrentino, certainly did. And should he have had a greater audience? I'm sure he should have, but you know, what are we crying about here? What are we feeling bad about here? That the New York Times didn't have the, you know, didn't know?
Well, you know, I mean, that a book review section that is considered to be sort of the foremost national newspaper book review continually disappoints. And maybe it's a sort of a personal thing. Maybe it's because I really would like to open up the New York Times Book Review and say, wow, this has done its job in actually covering book coverage. But then again,
Who do you say his job is? And why are you complaining? You live in San Francisco with a wonderful book section.
Yeah.
Oscar Villalone regularly, as far as I can tell, picks books that other people aren't paying attention to, and of diversity, and
We can talk about Washington Post Book World. We can talk about the Philly Inquirer. We can talk about a number of sections. But the problem is that people also, the publishing industry is extremely strangely attentive to the New York Times Book Review, and as a result, I guess, because everyone's focused, I mean, I kind of like side with you, but at the same time, I kind of side with the notion of that something that seemingly represents the literary, you know, that prides itself, that announces itself as the best literary weekly section in the country needs to be taken down. I mean, it's a natural kind of like, you know, well,
the only
Trotsky
person I, the only
impulse
person,
in me or something.
The only person I know that thinks it's the best is its editor.
Yeah, I know.
Does anybody else think it's the best? And what would that even mean for it to be the best? Well, why would one be the best? There's so many things to be served. You know, so I think that the you know, if you go back to the first question you asked about the state of the literary world, there's so much information out there that I think the issue is what's his name, Richard Langham, somebody just published a book called The Economy of Attention.
Yeah.
I think the issue is no longer about the availability of information. I think the issue is clearly about the availability of attention.
Yeah.
How much attention we can give, you know, to things. And so given the fact that there's all this information available out there, you know, the New York Times clearly is fighting a losing battle.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to be, even if they're perceived to be the king of the hill now, they're not going to be for much longer. Mm-hmm. So, but there was another point about whether any of this means anything to anyone. I mean, it only means something commercially. And why, as literary people, do we spend so much time worrying about the commercial aspect of it?
It's not
a critical. You wouldn't say that New York Times critiques rise to the level of serious criticism.
No.
So it's really only issue about commercial viability. I mean, you know, I was looking over a chat I had with Tom McGuane a few years ago. And we were talking about the Times again, you know.
Yeah.
And he told me that his then son-in-law, I think, was out on tour for his first or second novel, mm-hmm. Walter Kern, by the way.
Yeah.
And he got a bad review in the Times. The publisher canned the tour immediately.
That's just ridiculous. Yeah.
So by the way, there is something to be said about the strange relationship between the confused people in the publishing business and the New York Times, but that's not our problem, is it? I mean, if you're working for
it is. I mean, why can't this book like get the tour? Why is it so contingent upon the Times' response? I think exposing the Times' flummery for all of its, you know, manifold varieties is probably the best way to maybe get other people to understand that. Why do you value the Times so much? Why is it sort of? Why does it matter? I mean, to ignore it would be to, you know. Well, it could still actually continue to, you know, have its tentacles reach across various points in Manhattan and cause tours to be canceled.
There's something to be said for marshaling your own resources. I mean, there are lots of writers who I disagree with, Laura Miller is someone I've never been able to quite see the literary world in the same way as she. You know, I don't think she's a bad person. I happen to think she's probably a really nice person, and I give her credit for caring about the stuff she cares about. I don't for a minute doubt that she's not a dedicated reader and lover of literature. But if she infuriates me enough times in terms of disagreeing or finding irrelevant what she says, why would I want to put myself, you know, raise my blood pressure and do my system harm by reading her for the umpteenth time and being, you know, inflamed? You just make it, it's like, do you keep eating the same food you don't like? You know, the New York Times, you know, it's not on my radar anymore. I just don't care. I'll scan it just to see, you know, I don't know what, you know, guilty curiosity or something. But I'm much more inclined to read the stuff in the LA Times and in the Chronicle and the Denver Post and the Washington Post and the Chicago Tribune than I am to even reading the Boston Globe or the New York Times, you know. If they don't serve my purposes, and I just always wonder at some point why people who should know better continue to, you know, sort of, I mean, is it self-flagellation or something?
I don't know. I mean, it's more of just, again, maybe it boils down to this question of, you know, blogs and self-consciousness and self-awareness. Maybe it boils down to, like, to describe my own personal motivations for it, maybe it comes down to sort of like leveling out the playing field. Mm. You know,
But it's not. But you know, why have a battle between an apple and an orange? You know, how do you level out the playing field between two different?
So that people might better distinguish between the two fruit. You know.
That's a nice answer. That's very sweet. Yeah. Except that's not going to happen. They know they're not the same thing. I'm sure people. But so what does it mean to level out, to put Return of the Reluctant on the same, anywhere close to the same level or on the same playing field as the New York Times? It doesn't even make any sense. Why would you want to? I'm more inclined to read you because you're more fun, because you'll reach into subject areas that, you know, I'm more inclined to be interested in, and because you'll have frenzied, you know, fits of passion that I find amusing. The thing about a lot of these other mainstream media is...
At this point, the interview was disrupted by a strange, disheveled employee of Mount Auburn Cemetery, who was mystified to see two men with microphones talking in front of an obelisk. They were handed a strange leaflet. The rest of the interview tells the story.
Here's a souvenir of the rules.
Did you just get a ticket?
We got rules.
Yeah. Oh my god.
But look.
Ed's on his way to a second infraction.
Second. Yeah, I know. Jesus. No, but look at this.
Every city he goes to, he's in trouble.
There's nothing in here that says that we can't go ahead and record a conversation. There's nothing in here that says that.
What do you think?
It says photographing funerals is prohibited.
Yeah.
A special permit must be obtained for all filmmaking.
Are you a responsible adult?
Yes.
Look, okay. Look at this.
I'm a father.
A special permit must be obtained for all filmmaking, commercial photography, and photography with special equipment or posed subjects.
Oh.
Is this photography? No.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Go
ahead. Interpret it conveniently yourself.
If you want to get down to the semantics, this is bullshit.
we'll be in this Watertown slammer in about 5 minutes.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway. Getting back to whatever we were talking about.
I think we were talking about, like, the blogs versus the New York Times or something like that.
I mean, look, it's there is no level. There is no playing field. I mean, if there's a playing field, it's operating sort of horizontally. This guy actually seriously is walking up and down these stairs, like, repeatedly.
I'm impressed, yeah.
So, you know, I don't know what the competition is about, and I think the interesting thing is, can you imagine, really, I mean, imagine yourself sitting in one of these elevated office buildings with a bunch of these careerist journalists, so-called journalists, trying to make decisions about what they're going to publish and cover and stuff. I mean, please, that's got to be hell these days.
Boisterous or undignified conduct which disturbs the tranquility of the cemetery is prohibited.
This pylon.
That's
this pylon right here was complaining about our about the noise. Yeah. So you know, I just think that you know, it's on a week in and week out basis. There's so much. If you want to say that there's lots of stuff that should get our attention and should be attended to, or as you know Arthur Miller said, attention should be paid to. You know, why just keep reaching back for the convenience of? It's almost a sort of lockstep reaction to keep reaching back and attacking sort of the same dead horses. I mean, the New York, whatever it is, it's not changing. And, you know, Sam Tenenhaus may become more, you know, he may become more damaged by his sort of, he may become more Nixonian, you know, in his retreat into his own glories. But, you know, it's all kind of, I think, irrelevant to the task at hand, which is that any number of websites, you know, many of which are part of the literary, you know, are giving out, are run by smart, serious, decent people, giving out really good information, doing good work. That's what else, you know, why even, I mean, it's remarkable to me that you and Dan Green with regularity should, you know, should be horrified at the egregious depredations of the New York Times, and it's, you know, big deal, you know. I mean, I suppose somebody must care about them. You know, I mean, they are, after all, a big newspaper around the country, and, you know. But who's being misled?
Well, who's being misled is, like, perhaps some sort of, like, you know, someone who is in the Midwest who has
all
no
right,
sense.
Pick out the flyover zone people. That's right.
Yeah. Someone who doesn't, who wants to sort of, like, gravitate towards books and goes to, like, what is considered to be sort of the so-called first place to go because it's the New York Times and it's allegedly all the news that's fit to print. And they go ahead, and this is the book world as presented by them. I guess, you know, yes, it does get into this kind of meta commentary, but at the same time,
well, think about it. Really, what everybody knows is, it's no secret, what sells books?
Word of mouth.
Yeah. So the New York Times, you know, the reviews ripple through the bookstores and the book publishing industry. But
Look at the new Updike book that got terrible reviews and sold, like, you know, probably his strongest seller in years, actually. It's
there are all sorts of anomalies in the book business that, you know, I suppose are interesting and sort of are contraindications of the self-importance of the New York Times. You know, how many books has Updike written? 100? You know, he's of sufficient critical mass that, you know, if he had written, you know, he puts out a book called Terrorist. That seems to me to it'll hit the appropriate commercial chord. The book that I couldn't figure out that sold really well last year was Joan Didion's book, which is not a statement on the content, but except to say that I couldn't imagine her turning out a bestseller based on the sudden death of two of her closest family members.
I think because maybe death is one of those things that you just don't see in books, or people may not realize this, and maybe that's what they touch.
No, it's my own ignorance. I'm not saying it shouldn't have sold. Or, I mean, she's a great writer, and you know, but I mean, what was she best-selling before?
Culture, largely, in California, and, you know.
Were those considered bestsellers?
I don't know if Slouching or the White Album were actually bestsellers or not. I don't think so. I mean, I know that, you know, she was able to make a steady living, obviously, in her early career.
Stuff.
You know,
more like film and magazines.
Yeah, her and John Gregory Dunn writing all those movies. You know,
so, you know, there are all sorts of interesting. You know, it's like in the music business. Does anybody know what makes a hit record? You know, they only know after the fact. They don't know before when they put it out. So. And that's the thing. I wasn't even conscious of this, but Tom Beller pointed out to me that in my conversation with Russell Banks, that Banks sort of nailed me, but in a nice way, for spending a lot of time talking about the delivery system, meaning the book business, you know, and. And I realized that, you know, it's funny, I don't really want to, it's not that interesting to me, but there's something about it that draws, you know, there's something maybe unanswered or, you know, puzzling that I keep going back to, like, you know, why does a book get rejected 48 times and then win awards and sell well, or, you know, how does that happen? I mean, you know, so is that a book, a question about the book business or, you know, gatekeeping? I mean, you know, so, but whatever your question was, yes.
Okay. Fantastic.
I'm just trying to think of what to talk to. I'm just like totally.
My favorite book?
Wow, what is your, yeah, there you go. Favorite books.
Oh, I don't know. What do I think is the best book of the last 25 years?
Yes. You know, what are your thoughts on this whole contemporary fiction business or some all these alternatives that are now popping up? This whole, like, need to, I mean, again, it's, I, well, to me, it seems like very symptomatic of this whole list-making phenomenon that's cropped up in the last 10 years.
I think Clay Felker and his bunch at New York Magazine, I think, take credit for the sort of list, the avid list making, and then the list making of things that you weren't so obvious, like the 10 richest people or the 10 best school systems, you know, stuff like that.
But what I mean is like, a more specifically, it's like the AFI had like some another one of these bullshit lists where it's just like you have some sort of allegedly sort of like hallowed and sacred institution issuing like what they deem the best, you know, list.
I think there's a very understandable impulse there, but I think it gets perverted into something pretty untenable and stupid. Yeah. The good impulse is that really, don't you always try to keep somewhere in your top of mind or close to you a list of the things that you really like,
sure,
you know? And don't you frequently find when somebody asks you, you can't remember them? Yeah. So making the list sort of is a way of organizing information, but to assign it anything, any kind of hierarchical aesthetic stature is bullshit to me. I would never say like my 25 best books, or, you know, when people ask me like for my 5 favorite books, they usually get 30. Yeah. And I say that, you know, if you ask me tomorrow, the list will probably change. You know, there's no reason to, you know, rank them. There's no reason to rank aesthetic experiences.
Yeah.
You just try to, I think, stay in touch with the things that you've liked and experienced. So, you know, I sort of like the Brits, they may still do this. Isn't there like a desert island? Somebody does a show.
Oh, yeah, like the desert island tunes. Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's sort of a fun game. I mean, because it doesn't say what's the best. It's just like, you know, what do you want around you, you know? I also think, you know, there's an interesting, I now more and more understand when people who are required to pay attention to contemporary culture, why they feel relief or pleasure at going back to things that are considered classic. You know, I mean, you know, in the last 30 years, I've read 2 or 3 things that were published before 1935, you know, Gatsby being one of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, by and large, most of the things I read have been published since 1970. You know, I mean, like, by a wide margin. So every once, you know, like, I started reading the new translation of War and Peace, and I'm going, Jesus, let me stop and do it. I want to read this.
Yeah.
You know, there was a new edition of a new Library of America, Henry James, and I was reading. You know, it's like, this stuff is great. Why do I have to keep reading? You know, so personally, I would like to start a campaign to enlarge the window of our interest, you know. It's like, I think the New York Times, the New York Review of Books is doing a wonderful thing in republishing any number of books, including, you know, like, they just republished Beware of Pity by Stefan Zweig, who was like one of the great writers of his era, who's almost totally ignored now, you know. And Paul Collins does the same thing. You know, Paul Collins is this wonderful kid who hangs around stacks and finds 300-year-old wonderful pieces of literature, you know. And, you know, what it says is that we continually play the greatest hits game in literature and in music and stuff like that.
But only within, like, a recent sort of time span. Yeah, I mean, that's...
Well, the book business requires a 6-week, you know, maybe a 6-week window. It's you know, it's a little longer than the movie business that basically gives you 2 weekends.
Sure.
But that's the business. Why... we in our own, you know, why us literary journalists don't make a conscious effort to, you know, enlarge the window of attention is beyond me. What's our obligation not to? Anybody not getting, you're going to lose any advertising because you're not covering current stuff?
Yeah.
Or are the publicists not going to send you books because you paid it? You know, I'm starting to, in fact, I just wrote University of Nebraska Press because I wanted a copy of Stefan Zweig's memoir, which first came out in 1942 and was published originally by them in 1964. I'm waiting to see what the response is from the publicist. Like, why do you want, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, why don't you buy it, you know, or something like that. But I don't think that's going to happen because those presses are very good that way. But,
yeah.
You know, I think, and, you know, there's this bookstore in Cambridge called the Bryn Mawr Bookstore. It's one of these stores that supports the college by its whatever, its revenues. And they have... they have regular specials, and two or three times a year they have half price sale, which is like, you know, it's so wonderful. It's such a wonderful thing. And, you know, with regularity, I find books that are, you know, sort of obscure. And when I find them, I review them, you know, whatever context I'm talking about books. I'm not abashed about talking about a book that's 10 or 15 or 20 years old. And think about that. That's a big thing.
Yeah.
To talk about a book that's 10 or 15 or 20 years old?
Do you feel, though, I mean, like, when the publicists bombard you with their galleys in the mail and their ARCs, I mean, do you feel that reading those books or subscribing to those books sort of, like, eliminates some kind of sector that doesn't actually have that kind of publicity budget? And what steps do you take as just a reader to kind of, like, you know, think outside that very easy box because it comes directly to your, you know...
Well, first
box.
Of all, I have less and less fill out the review, yeah. except for certain presses. I don't fill out the review requests anymore. I do it on a weekly basis. If there's some books that, you know, if there are books I'm interested in, you know.
And I don't fill out at all.
Surprisingly, I bet you I get less... I bet you I get less books sent to me than almost any of you people. You people, meaning with regular web presences.
Yeah.
You know, and there are some publishers that I'm just shocked at the difficulty I have in getting things that I request.
Yeah.
Not just not getting sent to me, you know. And then on top of it, the third thing is that I don't know what world these people are living in that they will contact me, you know, within a week of somebody coming to town and asking me if I want to talk to them. Mm-hmm. Or questioning a request I have for a book for a person who's not coming to town.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, my experience with the book publishers is 90% wonderful because these people have always been good to me and the people who've been in it longer are, you know, but I just can't even, I try not to, you know, the only thing that bothers me on a yearly basis is when people like you go to the BEA and come back crowing about all these special ARCs you got, which I go, why didn't I get that?
Actually,
I
should note, I didn't actually, I think I came back with a total of 5 galleys, and these were like, it's just like, why give in to that sort of easy sort of mentality of like, I mean, I did that the first year I went, and I FedEx.
It's like a kid, it's like a kid.
But it's ridiculous. It's like, there's no way you'll be able to read it all.
To mention, like, what's the rush?
Yeah.
What is the point of reading I mean, you don't have anything to read right now that you have to read the advance copy?
Yeah, I know.
So, you know, honestly, I find I'm actually doing more reviews, so it helps me. It helps me sort of, you know, get work because if I physically see the book, then I, you know, this stuff usually has to be assigned 3 or 4 months in advance. So.
Yeah.
That's the only purpose it serves. It's just for me is remind me that I should be pitching my review now, as opposed to when the book is being published. So I learned a little bit about. I mean, I had to jumpstart my career, my so-called career, because I was an editor and publisher before I was a writer.
Yeah.
So now I'm like a forest animal, like everyone else.
Foraging. The editor and publisher business, it's sort of this kind of like secret identity or something. What happened during those days? What maybe you could give a sort of like a overview of how that life led to this life or
I don't think it's a secret. It's pretty I published a magazine for about 20 years in Boston. It was like a local
downtown style, yeah. you know, lifestyle tab, I think is what Stephen Heller described him as. And for half of its career, I published it on my own. And then for half of its career, it was owned by the company that, that owns the Boston Phoenix. Mm-hmm. And at some point, they sort of, they lost patience with its minimal, if at all, profitability, yeah. not to mention with my resistance to doing certain kinds of things that they were inclined to do. Plus, you know, after a while, a relationship sours, and, you know, I mean, it's not that they're not short-fingered vulgarians to begin with, but... So they decided to come up with a magazine that was a hipper, a younger, hipper iteration of the magazine that I was doing. And finally, they just fired me because I just didn't... I was getting, you know, recalcitrant in so many ways. And so at that point, you know, I started having to figure out what my next, what my options were, my revenue and career options were. So I was always looking, I was actually looking to try to do what I'm doing now via a bookstore's website.
Yeah.
And I think I had talked to the Harvard bookstore back in 99 or 2000. And then I also had three jobs with some of the worst media in, I mean, I can't imagine the string of bad luck I had.
Yeah.
So, you know, then I started doing identity theory with my colleague out of Florida.
Yeah.
And the critical mass of that got me in sort of in contact with a bunch of people, including the people at Morning News. And then I realized I don't really want to work, I don't want a job in the business. I'm not capable, I can't do a job in the business anymore. I mean, no one's going to hire me, you know, I'm 59 years old, no one's going to hire me at the requisite salary I should get
yeah.
when they can hire a 25-year-old kid that they have, you know, minimal expectations for as an editor or, you know. So, you know, it was a combination of the realities of the marketplace and my own personality. So I started foraging, doing, realizing that I actually needed to freelance and that I preferred to freelance. And so that's where it at. But I was, you know, I was sort of editor, creative director, publisher, interviewer, art director. You know, I was like pretty much the whole thing for this little magazine.
Did your battles with the magazine kind of, it seems to me that they may have influenced your sort of war on business and profitability and
well, part like of that. It, no, I don't. I certainly can't say, I mean, I'm sure I have an anti-business bias that's pathological that I,
yeah.
nothing I can do about it. But I certainly don't mind, I don't, it'd be silly to say that people shouldn't make money, but I think that if it's the highest value, and if it requires screwing other people and lying and putting out inferior product and being cynical and, you know, I don't see the point, you know. And by and large, that's what I think many media have turned into. You know, I love magazine. I love magazines. I mean, I loved the magazine I was doing because it was just an ongoing sort of postgraduate project. You know, I got to do, when I was my own, I could do whatever I wanted. And the enthusiasm it generated with people, with, you know, stylists and photographers and illustrators and cartoonists and writer and any number of people that they could do what they wanted, that it was yeah. like a sanctuary for their ideas, was so wonderful that it always made it fun. But when it got funneled into the context of, you know, a corporation, you know, it's like I always published party pictures, you know, and in fact in Boston I probably had the publication that was the first that regularly published them. Okay, I could show you my party pictures were not the normal party pictures. They weren't the three ups of three goofy people staring, you know, with red eye into a blink. You know, they weren't those. And you know, in fact, I used to have a running beef with the two women who are the gossip columnists. In fact, even the woman that preceded them, the gossip columnist at the Boston Herald, because I invariably would go to an event and catch them stuffing their faces at the buffet table and take pictures of them in not attractive poses. and publishing those pictures, okay? My colleagues, who are supposed to catch a break, I did that all the time, okay? So, anyway, so, but, you know, Stuff Magazine regularly had party pics. And then, you know, you pick up a magazine in town now, pick up a magazine anywhere in the world now, and every magazine, every newspaper has party pics, okay? Yeah. Well, I did it because there was a funny thing about it. There was a funny way of doing it, you know. But now, you can't take a picture which in any way offends anyone and publish it.
Why not?
You can't because, you don't.
Yeah.
The people who publish don't. The fact of the matter is, there was a period of time when it was possible, when the amount of publications and media that were visionary were... I don't think they were, there was a greater number of them, but I think there was a sufficient number of them to sort of create an equilibrium between the visionary and the market-driven. The market-driven being the ones that always sort of, came after, you know, fill the market niche afterwards, you know. But, you know, in a celebrity culture, you don't have, Wired was a visionary magazine. You know, Spy, in some sense, was a visionary magazine. Originally, I think, was it Forbes? Not Forbes, no, what was it? Fortune yeah. Magazine. I mean, Luce did incredible things with Fortune Magazine in the 30s. He used the best photographers and the best writers, and the best art. It was an incredible magazine. It was devoted to money. Yeah. Is devoted to American capitalism, yeah. But he used people like Walker Evans. I mean, you know, so, but today, you know, I mean, you know, you know a golden age is over when a thing is over, when it doesn't resemble itself anymore. You know, when magazines now look like talk shows and television shows and video games, they're not magazines, they're something else, you know, so.
But what's wrong with, I mean, if you're talking about facsimiles or are you talking about influence?
Oh, I'm talking about some kind of sort of aesthetic coherence, you know. I mean, it's okay. I guess it's okay for a magazine to look like a video game.
Yeah.
If that's what you want, you know. But I hearken back to the sort of like the Esquire's, you know, Arne Ginrich's Esquire, or do you remember a magazine called Ramparts?
Yes.
It came out of San Francisco.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Mother Jones is probably an honorable successor to that. You know, what's his name? Ralph Ginsberg published a magazine called Avant-Garde, of which maybe I think there were 30 issues. If you look at those magazines, I mean, they published stuff and they played with, you know, Herb Lubalin, I think, was played around with some groundbreaking type fonts in Avant-Garde, including Avant-Garde.
Yeah.
The type of, so, I mean, these publications were, you know, there were fields, there were pastures for all sorts of fertile ideas that actually, I think, self-evidently, I don't think anybody would argue that the stuff that they published and presented wasn't compelling, didn't have, you know. Today, you want to show me a copy of Us Weekly or People that doesn't look like the last issue? Is there anything distinctive about any of those magazines in the history of their own histories? Does not every issue look like every other issue?
Pretty much, but
it
also,
doesn't.
I was going to say though. I mean, you could also make this case about advertising and layout because of Photoshop. The rise of Photoshop has pretty much killed art direction in the sense that people aren't like, you know, you look at even an advertisement for like, you know, produce in California in like the 1920s. It's utterly beautiful. Yeah. There's actual craftsmanship to it.
Right.
There's actual painting, you know.
Right. And actually people, you know, chronicle books will come out with a book of tomato or orange box labels.
Yeah.
That's how beautiful that stuff was.
Know.
Sure.
I know.
Yeah. But, you know, which is not to say that there isn't contemporary beauty and, you know, and wonder and that even in the minute commercials, which I don't think they feel required to have like 140 edits in 60 seconds now,
yeah.
but you know, that something wonderful isn't happening in those things either. But you know, by and large, it's all kind of forgettable and mind numbing,
yeah.
and cynical,
yeah.
Really. You know, I don't think, you know, and this in addition to, do you know any advertising marketing people who don't think they're the most brilliant people in the world?
Not really.
Every one of them feels blessed to think that they've brought, you know, the wonders of capitalism and the market economy to the world. It's just the, and television people
particularly,
are the worst.
Particularly the clueless ones, yeah. I mean, well, actually, I am running out of tape, but I wanted to at least ask you a question about how you go about setting up literary interviews, and what is your criteria for who
As you well know, I get paid a lot for these. And the publishing companies, I mean,
I'm sitting on a condo in Malibu. Yeah,
a lot of people, I mean, the recent exposure of our devious methodologies to enrich ourselves.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing about not wanting to work. I mean, almost all my choices are my own, and they're not particularly, they're kind of intuitive. They're not well-reasoned. They're not deliberated on, you know. I just talk to who I want to talk to, you know, and the fact of the matter is I'll talk to anyone. I mean, anyone, anywhere, anyone.
Yeah.
I mean, anyone. I mean, an old guy at Dunkin' Donuts, I'll talk to him.
Nicole Richie, you'll talk to her.
Absolutely. Who is she?
Paris Hilton, Nicole Richie, that whole sort of socialite set.
No.
Yeah.
I suppose there's something funny to be gained from talking to someone like that, but it won't be from me. Uh-huh. No, I won't talk to them. But I think I've learned something sort of later in my life that, you know, it's not that I'll talk to someone, I'll listen to them.
Yeah.
That I think that I try to present a context in which people are, and it's not hard, you know, because watch me, I've just blabbed away. Tell someone, you know, give someone the sense that you're listening to them. They'll talk to you until they die.
Oh yeah.
They'll die talking.
Well, not only that, but have you come across this sort of thing where, I mean, I've had this happen with a few people where you're essentially kind of like the intellectual equivalent of a bartender or a cab driver, where you're sitting there and before you've set up tape or anything, they're like sitting there revealing all these intimate details about their lives to someone else, and it's just very, very
it
strange.
Yeah, I've had people have sort of emotional breakdowns.
Yeah.
I've had that happen, and but really, you know, think about what you are presenting to someone when you're talking to, you know, you like me talk to writers mostly,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know, when you talk to a writer, I mean, you suggest to them that you care about their work, that you paid attention to their work, that you know something about their work, and your questions more or less indicate that. And if they see that you're listening to them and that you paid attention to them, that's almost as intimate as you can be. Can you be more intimate than, it's like the editor, I was talking to Fred Ramey at Unbridled last week, and he was telling me that two of his authors still get enraged over certain issues they had about books that he edited. I go, like, what's the surprise?
Yeah.
You know, what do you think, that they're going to go, oh yeah, that's okay, mess with my work, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's you know, that's good. That's what if you connect with people about what they care about, that's what's going to happen.
Sure.
And that's good. You know,
but what do you think accounts for, like, aside from obvious kind of monetary influences, what do you think accounts for, like, the real lack of, I guess, so-called literary journalism? The fact that, you know, most journalists, when they interview an author, don't even bother to read the books or previous books, or ask them questions that fall outside of the whole sort of, like, you know, standard boilerplate. You know?
Well, it's like, I talked to Gail 2 years ago. I talked to Gail Caldwell right here.
Yeah,
actually, it was right there. But up here, and she was saying to me, you know, she went to the local bookstore. It had been a while, because why does she have to go to a bookstore?
Yeah.
And she couldn't believe at how shrunk down the fiction section was.
Yeah.
So for us, it's a big world. The literary fiction world is a big world. For most of the world, they don't care. They could care less.
Yeah.
Who cares? And you know what? I just actually, after years of trying to figure out how to advance my book project, somebody helped me figure out that the best way to do it is to not concentrate solely on literary fiction writers. You know, I hadn't figured out that the kiss of death for this project was to concentrate only, and as soon as I moved out of that narrow world, I, you know, my possibilities blossomed. So, yeah. You know, so, I mean, you can't, you know, I mean, it's a little bit self-centered of us to think, why doesn't the schnook on the 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock news ask better questions, you know? But that's okay. I mean, what are we for? I mean, would we be here if those people were doing, you know, the good work?
Maybe, maybe not. I mean,
I think not. I think not.
So you're saying, you're suggesting that we're both sort of driven by, I mean, you know, I could also respond by saying, well, then why care about it so much, Robert? Why care about it, El Rojo? Because, you know, it's going to exist with or without you. It's just like the New York Times.
Why care? Oh, why care about which?
Yeah. Why care about, like, fulfilling these, like, mammoth sort of interviews?
Well, that's not mine. I mean, I'm not doing this and going, I'm on a horse with my lance, and I'm going out and tilting against the world. I'm just doing what I like to do, and yeah. Thank goodness. I mean, I'm only doing it and have continued to do it because, I like it. I get great satisfaction about having these conversations. I mean, what could be better, really?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And two, people are so kind to me, and people notice my work and say good things about my work,
yeah.
and in my life it sort of reverberates. I mean, you know, I've talked to Martin Amis 4 or 5 times.
Yeah.
That's 5 hours in my life, or 4 hours in my life, that I spent with Marty.
Yeah.
Or Richard Ford or Rick Russo. I mean, you know, every few years I know I'm going to have a conversation with these guys, and I love these guys.
Yeah.
Or Amy Bloom, you know, or Andrea Barrett. You know, I mean, these people are, I mean, you know, so I don't have to get any sort of psychological, emotional nourishment
yeah.
out of walking around in the streets being alienated from this, you know, post-industrial
yeah.
capitalist.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, it's a personal thing. I'm not crusading. I'm not a missionary, you know. I mean, I'm a leftist, you know, and I'd like to tear down, you know, a social culture that is just so unjust, but, you know, my son and I aren't jumping at the barricades. We just have to, you know, we have to sort of remember the serenity prayer or something.
I will ask one last question because this is going to run out.
You can't have my PIN number.
Yeah. Damn it! You know, we're going to cash in on that colossal fortune you have made from doing all these literary interviews.
So
we're going to go ahead and take
you
it all today.
Support
right
your condo.
Before we left, yeah, exactly.
Support your condo from someone else.
Yeah. No, do you find yourself learning a lot more unexpectedly from these interviews, or you know, do you see your interviews have sort of like subconscious themes or topics of, I guess, personal education come up for you during the course of all?
Well,
these?
A lot of it is personal education for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just been one long postgraduate thing. I from time to time have to kind of refresh what I'm doing in terms of these conversations, because, you know, I think I get personally lazy and rely on sort of a certain, I don't know what,
yeah.
certain way of doing things. So, but it is a lot about learning any number of things I didn't know about the people, things I just didn't know that I encountered in reading of a book, or reading about a person who wrote the book, or about, you know, their family, you know, any number of things. So, yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. It's just the ongoing kind of wonderful information and stories that keep coming my way. I just love it, you know. People tell good stories. I mean, you know, half of the conversations are about the stories people tell in the telling of the stories, in how they wrote the stories, and, you know, what they didn't write in the stories, and any number of things. So it's if it's not an infinitely large, if it's not an infinite universe of story, it's certainly very large and you know, for all practical purposes, endless, you know.
Gotcha. Well, speaking of endless, well, I'm going to have to
Amen.
Unfortunately cut this short, but it was a pleasure to finally meet with you and
yes,
talk with
of
you.
Course.
Thanks so much.
We'll have to do this when I
have a hard time taking the easy way.